Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Policy Director, Josh Gordon, as well as staff writer and White House reporter for the LA Times, Eli Stokels. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The partisan battle over border funding will likely be back in the spotlight soon. Senate Republicans are considering reducing the labor HHS education bill by about $5 billion for fiscal year 2020 to provide additional wall funding in response to the president's request. If this is the path taken, it will most certainly prompt a fight with the Democratic-controlled House. In the House, appropriators have written the Homeland Security bill with no new border wall funding, and the president has asked for $8.6 billion in wall funding for fiscal year 2020. In other words, same bat time, same bat channel. As this same fight last fiscal year produced a breakdown in the appropriations process and a 35-day shutdown. The Senate has yet to draft any of its 12 appropriations bills. Appropriators had been waiting on an overall budget deal that set new spending levels, which has since been passed. The House has already written its 12 bills and passed 10 of them, but it will need to undergo a rewrite to abide by the new budget agreement. For instance, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the House's Homeland Security spending bill is about $3 billion over its limit. Even without the Homeland Security bill, the House will have to trim about $15 billion from its overall non-defense discretionary spending levels. Then, of course, the House and Senate will likely have to reconcile their packages of bills in order to pass them into law. A debate over rescissions may be coming back as well, as the Trump administration appears to be laying the groundwork for canceling funding already appropriated by Congress for foreign aid. The move could affect as much as $4 billion, roughly 7% of the $55 billion allocated over the last two fiscal years. Various members of Congress have vowed to fight such a measure. Up next, I'll be joined by Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon. We will be discussing a Congressional Budget Office report on various levels of debt and their impact on gross national product. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Josh Gordon. Josh is Concord's policy director. He conducts research on the federal budget, healthcare policy, and tax policy. He has a PhD from the University of Florida, and he's been on the show several times to share his expertise. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Josh.
It's a pleasure to be back, Chase.
Happy to have you on the show once again. This time I'd like to talk about a recent Congressional Budget Office report called The Impact of Various Levels of Federal Debt on GNP and GNP Per Capita. And by report, it's basically a letter. But maybe for our listeners, you can give a quick description of what this letter or report was meant to communicate and why.
Yeah, this letter is basically a follow-up to the Congressional Budget Office long-term budget outlook. They release that long-term budget outlook every summer, basically. This summer was no different. And what they try and do is give perspective on the future of fiscal policy over the next 30 years. And one of the key points they try and make, which the Concord Coalition really is our reason for existence, is that if you have large debt growing over the long term, you will wind up having a slower economy. And one of the things they've started to do more recently is try and put that into perspective. When we say a slower economy, what does that mean? And they come up with this measure, which is really a little bit tricky. It's called GNP per capita, which is gross national product per person, where you simply take the size of the gross national product, divide it by the number of people, and get this per person number. This is helpful because it gives us a kind of more bite-sized number to wrap our heads around instead of things like $22 trillion or $37 trillion, which are what the projected growth in the debt is. You put it in this per capita number, so you have a kind of a better per-person number. The real tricky thing with that, though, is that this doesn't mean every American will be a certain amount richer by that time. This is kind of just a really broad average.
And you mentioned GNP, and oftentimes when we're talking about the economy, you hear GDP being thrown around. Is there a difference between GNP and GDP?
Yeah, there is a difference, and the reason they use GNP is because GNP is a better number to work with when we're trying to divide by the number of Americans, simply because it limits economic activity to domestic activity and doesn't include as much international measurement. So this gives us a better kind of per-person national income number, whereas GDP would not just be per-person national income.
Josh, this letter is a follow-up to a couple reports, as you mentioned, for the Congressional Budget Office. And in the letter, they look at a few different scenarios and their impact on GNP and GNP per capita. I think the CBO looks at its own baseline and then the alternative scenarios, correct?
Yeah, their baseline, as your listeners probably know, is just their assumption or projection for what happens if current laws remain in place and no changes are made between now and 2049. As we know, that's not always the most plausible projection. So they include what they call an alternative fiscal scenario, which incorporates really two main things. One, it assumes that the tax cuts that are scheduled to expire in 2025, along with a couple other smaller tax cuts, continue to be extended throughout that 30-year period. And then the other part of the alternative scenario is actually something that is going to happen, because when they released their baseline, Congress and the president had not yet agreed on spending levels for the next 2 years. Now that they have agreed on spending levels, that part of the alternative scenario, which assumed that Congress and the president do away with spending caps, which is what they just did, makes up kind of the other piece. So if you assume that Congress and the president do away with spending caps, which they already did, and allow the tax cuts to continue, then you get what CBO calls their alternative fiscal scenario.
So it seems like right now we're in between the original baseline CBO put out and this alternative scenario they put out as well. What's the likelihood that the tax cuts are extended, you know, taking us almost entirely into the alternative scenario?
Well, judging based on recent and past performance of Congress, I'd say it's pretty likely these tax cuts get extended. Our hope, of course, is that they don't, either by having them just completely expire or by having some sort of tax reform between now and 2025 when the expiration happens, which will bring in at least as much revenue as the CBO baseline, if not more. So I would say the alternative scenario is the one that your listeners should think about the most when we think about kind of the long-term hole that we're in.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Josh Gordon, Concord Coalition's policy director. We're discussing a follow-on letter by the Congressional Budget Office after some of its recent reports discussing its extended baseline and alternative scenarios. And Josh, I wanted to piggyback off of what we were just talking about in those two particular CBO scenarios or projections. How do they differ either in their projected debt-to-GDP ratio, and even their GNP per per capita analysis that they went through with this letter?
Yeah, so the main difference between the baseline and the alternative scenario is that our debt held by the public will be 144% projected under kind of just the baseline. That's compared to the about 78% of GDP that we're currently at. So you have a pretty large increase just in the baseline. And then the alternative scenario, you wind up with debt to GDP of a 219% by 2049. So pretty big difference there between the baseline and the alternative, and obviously a very large difference between the 78% debt held by the public that we're at right now to the 219% by 2049 under the more plausible alternative fiscal scenario. What the difference between the alternative fiscal scenario and the baseline does for GNP per capita is pretty dramatic. So under the baseline, GNP per capita goes from about $65,000 per capita now to about $94,000 per capita in 2049. Now, the alternative, more plausible scenario with much larger debt in 2049 has the GNP per capita about $3,400 per person lower than just under the baseline. So the interesting thing here is even though debt is growing, we have to remember that the GNP grows over time anyway. So that's why you have this just regular increase in per capita income from about $65,000 to $94,000 over 30 years. But $3,400 lower per capita under the alternative fiscal scenario is a pretty big deal. So what we want to think about is if we actually can reduce the size of our debt over time to be better for the economy than even the baseline. That's how we can actually have increased economic growth from lower deficits. If we were able over time to keep the debt at about the level that it is today, you get about $3,600 per capita higher economic growth over the 30-year period. And if we're somehow able to do even better than that and get debt down to about 42% of GDP, which is the historical average, you get about $5,500 per capita increase in the size of the economy. So if you look at relative to the most plausible scenario, the alternative fiscal scenario, where debt is growing to 220% of GDP, and we're somehow able to prevent that from happening and just stay at today's level of debt, you get an increase of $7,000 per capita in the size of the economy. And if we're able to lower that even further to the historical level, it winds up being about $9,000 per capita higher. And I think these numbers are so important because they're putting into perspective how important it would be if we were able to lower debt over the long term, how that has a real impact in the size of the economy, and we can kind of understand that impact by dividing that size of the economy to get our national income per person. So these numbers have been very helpful when CBO puts them out. And I don't know about you, Chase, but one way I like to use these numbers is we have this budget exercise we call Principles and Priorities, where we go around the country and have groups sit down and make fiscal choices over like a 10-year budget to figure out what amount of deficit reduction they can agree on with the group that they're in. And I want to make it real to those people what happens once they make these decisions. And so what I always say is at the end, when we tabulate how well we did, I kind of grade them by how well their choices work to lower the debt over the long term and then to increase national income per person. And so these CBO numbers allow us to put that context into how well we do. Unfortunately, our exercise is a little bit limited in terms of how much deficit reduction you can actually achieve over 10 years. It's actually very difficult to have really large deficit reduction just over a 10-year period. There just aren't enough real options that, that we can give people. But I would say my average group gets about $3 to $4 trillion in savings over 10 years when they have these agreements. And if you get about $4 trillion in savings, you approach the current level of debt, 78% of GDP, over the long term. So as we talked about, if you kind of look at this CBO letter, approaching the current levels over 30 years of debt, again, would get us about $7,000 per person in extra national income by making those responsible fiscal choices. And these are things we see people do all the time in these groups, is reach an agreement on that kind of deficit reduction. And so this is a very difficult road ahead to achieve this deficit reduction, but it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that we can do it, because we see groups do this around the country all the time.
And I certainly agree with you, Josh. The budget exercise principles and priorities, and relating it to, I guess, scores like this and helping people understand how their high-level policy decision could potentially impact their own pocketbook is really important and really crucial in understanding the impact of these issues. And I'd like to take it a step further. You mentioned a range of savings or increase in GNP per capita. You said $3,000, $9,000 per capita. That's a big deal over 30 years. Can you take it even more granular and help us understand why seemingly small numbers like that can have such a large impact?
Well, just kind of on a simple percentage basis, if average income in the country is about $90,000 to $95,000 in 2049, and we can all kind of think about this in our own life. If your average income, you kind of know what that means, what your expenses are. And what we're talking about is, in the kind of best case scenario where debt gets back to the historical level over that time period, you're adding about $9,000 per capita, which would be 10% of your income. So it's really giving you an income bonus of about 10%. Which I think we all would agree in our own lives, if we look at what we make and someone told us we were getting an increase in our annual income of about 10%, we'd be pretty happy. That would be a pretty impressive feat. Now, again, I want to tell your listeners that we're simplifying this to a pretty large degree, because it is true that because of how kind of income is skewed in the country, it's not exactly the case that this increase in the economy would distribute evenly across all income categories. But it isn't kind of as a heuristic to kind of figure out the size of these numbers. Pretty helpful to think about that 10% income bonus if we have more responsible fiscal policy. And then, obviously, the choices that we make along the way to get that deficit reduction also have a pretty big impact on the size of the economy. We can make choices fiscally that can slow economic growth over the long term. We can, for instance, raise the wrong kind of taxes. We can cut spending that would be put into investments and help grow the economy. So not all deficit reduction would be created equal in terms of increasing economic growth, but there are things we could do that would reduce the deficit, but also potentially increase the size of the economy even more than what we're talking about just looking at these numbers. There could be tax reform that can help increase revenue while also increasing economic growth. There are certain forms of Social Security reform that could help increase economic growth and also help reduce the deficit over the long term. And you know, we could talk about that forever, the choices that we're making along the way. But just from a pure fiscal perspective, having a large increase in debt is negative for the economy, and figuring out a way to reduce that debt is positive for the economy. And that's really what these numbers boil down to.
I think that's a great place to leave it today, Josh. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon discuss a CBO letter that analyzed the impact of various levels of federal debt on GNP per capita. Thanks again for joining the show, Josh.
My pleasure, Chase.
After the break, I'll be joined by Eli Stokols, a staff writer and White House reporter for the LA Times. We'll be discussing what it's like covering elections and writing on policy issues. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Eli Stokols, a staff writer and White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Washington, D.C. Bureau. Eli is a veteran of Politico and the Wall Street Journal, where he covered the 2016 presidential campaign and then the Trump White House. He's also a graduate of UC Berkeley and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome to Facing the Future, Eli.
Thanks, Chase.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You and I actually met during the 2016 primary, and you were all over the place, it seemed like, at that point. But before we dive into what it was like, I'm actually curious how you got interested in becoming a reporter and what that environment is like today.
Well, it's funny. I got interested in journalism when I was growing up in Southern California. My parents were pretty, you know, up to speed on what was going on. They thought it was important. We'd get Newsweek magazine back when Newsweek magazine published a weekly print issue. We'd watch the evening news back, you know, around the dinner table back when the country still more or less had, you know, everybody watching three network nightly news broadcasts. The news environment was not nearly as, you know, bifurcated and diffuse as it is now. And, you know, that was sort of that kind of, I guess, lit the fuse. You know, I understood that what was happening in the world was important, that you needed to pay attention to it. You know, and as I went through school, I realized I was pretty poor at the math and science courses, much better at writing and much more interested in English and history and those sorts of things. The history major in college, you know, and basically once I realized I wasn't going to be a big league ball player, it was journalism was the next thing on the list.
Yeah, I think I had a real quick realization that I wasn't going to be a big league ball player, probably like 13 years old. So I'm with you there.
It comes for most of us, yeah, at some point.
I know, right? I wish I could, you know, have my job be, you know, playing baseball every day. And I'm sure it's very tiresome, but it looks like a lot of fun, too. And speaking of fun, it looked like you were having at least a little bit of fun during the 2016 primary here in New Hampshire. So can you give our listeners a recap of what that was like for you? Was it exciting? Was it a little bit overwhelming because there were so many candidates, which is a little reminiscent of what it's like this cycle?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think my wife is now covering the Democratic primary, and, you know, I often tell her that, you know, the primary, like the election, the 2 years, there's many different iterations of the campaign. You know, there's the early stages when everybody has a chance, then you can start to see the field narrowing. Then you get the actual caucuses and primaries. Then after that, you know, it sort of slows down. You get to the conventions, and then after the conventions, you have that sprint in the general election to the first Tuesday in November. And, you know, the 2015 and 16, that was really my first opportunity to cover a presidential campaign at the national level. I'd covered 2004, 8, and 12 from my vantage point in Louisiana, and then in Colorado. So I covered it from sort of a state-based level. And Colorado was interesting because that was a pretty relevant state back in 2008 and 2012, less so at the moment. But, you know, I had never been, I never spent months and months on end flying back and forth to Iowa and to New Hampshire. And so, you know, it's a lot of fun just getting to see politics, national politics, playing out on that smaller scale, seeing voters actually get to interact with the candidates, ask them questions, some of them pretty important and relevant, some of them also important, but kind of esoteric. And you know, you say, oh, I can't believe that person just asked that question. That was fascinating. Candidate didn't really seem to have a great answer prepared for that. But it's just, you know, that's the special thing about these early states is that voters and reporters really get an opportunity to get up close with the candidate. As far as a reporter, I would say it's probably the most fun part of the campaign is having that kind of access and having everything kind of laid out before you, all the possibilities, not really knowing which way it's going to go. I was assigned to the Republicans in 2015, specifically Jeb Bush. You know, initially the folks at Politico, my editors, said, you know, Jeb's got a good chance of being the nominee. He's the only one that it makes sense for us to sort of cover one-on-one. Everybody else we're playing sort of zone defense with, but they put me on Jeb. And it was funny how it worked because, you know, Donald Trump started getting to Jeb, and Marco Rubio wanted to undermine Jeb. So his people decided that I was going to be their friend and they would leak me a lot of information about Jeb that, you know, Oppo, that the Rubio folks wanted to get out. So you start really getting to know folks on a number of different campaigns. And, you know, everything, it just sort of takes off from there. I'd say the first several months of that, we're watching Jeb try and get this, you know, huge campaign off the ground, and it didn't go very well, and that was a big story. And the success of Trump was also something I don't think anyone really anticipated early on in that campaign. And as he continued to rise in the polls, as he stayed there after the first couple of debates, you know, people realized in newsrooms that this is a real thing and that Donald Trump might be around for a while. And so at that point, they sent me up to Trump Tower to meet with Corey Lewandowski and Hope Hicks, who were then basically the brain trust of the Trump campaign. And they sent me up there to be kind of to play good cop, because we had a reporter who kind of exhausted their patience. And obviously that's easy to do. But he sort of ran afoul of the Trump folks because he didn't write about the campaign all that seriously. So they sent me up there, and I went to Trump Tower, and we sat in the basement of the lobby, the atrium, and we had a conversation. And I, you know, they offered all kinds of access and made it very clear that they would be very open to reporters who they liked. And that was sort of an uncomfortable thing, but it you know, foreshadowed the way that they have always, and the way the president himself thinks about the press, which is this is a transactional relationship. He may appreciate the job that we're supposed to do privately, but, you know, deep down he believes that he is owed a certain kind of coverage that aligns with his own view of the world. And was going to be much more open-facing to reporters who were a bit more credulous, you know, a bit less skeptical, and who took his campaign seriously. And you know, that was an interesting situation to have to learn to navigate over the course of the campaign, because at one point somebody at Politico published an article featuring Trump biographers talking about Trump's upbringing, and there was something in there about his father. And Trump didn't like it. And the next thing you knew, we were, as an organization, all of Politico was banned from attending Trump rallies and Trump campaign events. And that made life tricky for a few months. Had to figure out other ways to write about him and other ways to get to events that weren't official campaign events. And, you know, so again, just different iterations of a long campaign. And, it seems like a long time ago, but also the memories come right back when you start thinking about them.
Yeah, it's really interesting how that works. Time flies, but you can be brought back to that experience that you had. And speaking of that experience, was it difficult for you personally? You mentioned sort of the struggle Politico had in staying on President Trump's good side, at that point candidate Trump. Was it difficult for you personally to sort of walk that line and have, you know, quality, meaningful coverage of the candidate while also trying to stay in the door so you can continue to talk to him?
Yeah, I mean, maintaining access to a person, politician like Donald Trump is tricky for journalists and will always be. You know, when I was writing about Jeb Bush, I knew that he was not happy with a lot of our coverage, but I knew that his campaign folks would still deal with us. They were never going to shut us out completely. And so, you know, when that happened with the Trump folks, yeah, it was different. It was hard to figure out, okay, how are we going to cover this meaningfully? You know, and everybody struggled with that. I mean, we wrote, you know, when I was working at Politico, there was more interest in, you know, the internal dynamics of the campaign and the infighting between Lewandowski and Paul Manafort when that was going on for several months. So we wrote a lot of stories about them fighting about the direction of the campaign, and perhaps that was interesting to the political audience. You know, the interesting thing about Donald Trump is you can cover him, and this is still true, you can cover him just about as well just by watching him on television as you can, you know, as you normally would, trying to, you know, get deeply sourced with his advisors, and to figure out what he's going to do ahead of time, because this is just the guy who doesn't do a lot of planning before he acts. He doesn't have a lot of advisors. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, covering him is just doing play-by-play. And you can do that off the TV. You can do that up close and personal. And obviously, you don't just want to be watching television and writing about what you see on television. You want to be adding value for your reader. But, you know, at the same time, when you talk to people around him, they say, watch your Twitter for his response. We don't know what he's going to do. Or they'll say, we think he's going to do this, but, you know, usual caveats apply, which means, you know, they're hedging and saying, you know, we think this is the plan, but you never know with this guy. And so it's very unpredictable. And I think, you know, in terms of the access question, you know, I always felt like my job is to report what I see. And my job is to contextualize as much as I can, you know, in terms of, you know, does this make sense? Does this align with reality? Is he contradicting himself? Is he being factually accurate? Is he intentionally misleading people? And I think, you know, you just sort of try to assess that as you go. You try not to overdo it. You try to present the facts. But, you know, sometimes you have to connect a few dots. And if those are stories that, you know, get under the president's skin and mean that some of his advisors not going to return your calls or not going to offer you an interview, you know, so be it. And I think that, you know, honestly, the value of having access even to the president himself, not just to advisors, but even to the president himself, is far less than it would be under a normal administration, because he says so much and yet so little of it, you know, stuff that you can really write down and say, okay, I'm confident that that's actually how it's going to be, because he's always hedging. He's always leaving himself opportunities to kind of go one way or the other. I was on the Air Force One with him last week as he was flying back from the visit to Dayton and to El Paso. And he came back to the back of the cabin and he spoke to the press pool, to the seven of us reporters or so who were back there, for about 45 minutes. And I'm not going to reveal any of the things that he said, but I can tell you a lot of the things that he's said, it sounds like he's making news. But then after the fact, you go over it, you listen to it again, and you hear that it's actually not as newsy as you think, because he's kind of hedging or he's not very specific. And in other cases, when he does make news, if it's off the record, chances are he's going to reveal it himself on the record in short order. He told us on the plane, I'll say this because he's now said it himself publicly, he told us on the plane that he just received another letter from Kim Jong-un. And we recognized that that was news, and we, you know, members of the pool said, okay, we're going to hold on to this pretty tight, because that's not, you know, we can't let this get out there. But, you know, the next day, I think, or maybe it was 2 days later, he just, you know, mentions, he gets asked about that in a, you know, gaggle when he's leaving the White House, and he comes forward with it. So he is a pretty forthcoming person about sort of what's in his head at any given time. It's just hard to know if that is, you know, if it's sort of solid or if he's just thinking about things. You know, he floated to us on the plane and he let us put it on the record that he was again thinking about pardoning former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich. Well, we put that out there publicly. And then, you know, now he tweets over the weekend, well, it's under consideration, because I think he got a lot of negative feedback. So it's hard to sort of put too much stock in any one thing, one piece of information that you get from him. And that makes covering him hard. That makes it hard if you're another foreign leader dealing with him, because you don't really know if he's going to follow through, how serious he is. He's very unpredictable, and he thinks that that's a strength, but it can also be, you know, destabilizing, certainly for the stock market and just sort of for the country, I'd say, as a whole, when you're sort of bouncing back and forth from, you know, between all these uncertain possibilities.
So it sounds like, A, you're being kept on your toes quite a bit, and B, you're probably hitting refresh on your laptop to watch the Twitter feed update on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, if you write a story about this guy, you better publish it, because nothing holds. Nothing, you know, you can't say, oh, that's a great story, we'll run that in 3 days. You know, it's going to be on to something else.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Eli Stokols from the LA Times. We're discussing what it's like covering elections and the campaign trail. And I want to get into your work in covering the White House and the press pool, especially especially. But before we go that route, I did have a couple more questions. One question is somewhat trivial. This one might impact your own future political outlook, and that is, which state, Iowa or New Hampshire, was your favorite to visit when you were in covering the 2016 primary?
Well, I will say the nice thing about New Hampshire, in addition to all the great diners and the really nice people and the amazing lakes, is that it's a lot smaller and easier to get around. You don't have any like 4 or 5 hour drives across the state like you do in Iowa. I don't want to play favorites here, but I love coming up to New Hampshire, especially in the summer and the fall. I had a sort of dicey, I remember one very dicey, snowy drive a few days before the New Hampshire primary, where I was had to go from Manchester to Portsmouth and back in a rental car that, let's just say, was not four-wheel drive equipped. And that was not my favorite moment of the primary, but I love coming up there. And, you know, the Iowa State Fair that's happening this week, I will say, is a lot of fun for any reporter to be out there. My wife is out there right now, and I'm jealous of that reporting experience. You know, being a White House reporter, you realize, there's been a lot of news. It's high profile, whatever, but the campaign rolls around, and you suddenly see all your colleagues going back off to Iowa, New Hampshire, and in my case, not just my colleagues, but my wife, and in addition to missing her when she's gone, I'm a little jealous, Those are fun trips.
Your political future is preserved. You give a very political answer in finding the high notes in Iowa and New Hampshire, so great job there. Another question I had, are you seeing any parallels? You mentioned when you were covering Jeb, how you would get information leaked to you by different campaigns as other candidates sought to attack Jeb Bush. Are you seeing similar parallels in the 2020 cycle with Vice President Biden? I know you're not directly covering it yourself, but I feel like there's some comparison that can be made there.
Yeah, I mean, I think within the Democratic, with those campaigns, I do think that there's probably more of the traditional oppo research shop in-house that is looking at, who do we need to beat, and trying to figure out, where are they vulnerable? What do we need to get in front of a reporter? And I'm certain that continues to happen on the Democratic side. I think it's harder, once we get to the general election with Trump, because, so much is just out in the open. And reporters have, I know there are some frustrated Democrats who feel like the media has not done a good enough job, sort of laying out the case, all the sort of personal foibles that Trump has. But I think that's not true. I think, if you go back to 2016, you had the Access Hollywood tape, you had articles about his family and the real estate business. I mean, his past is pretty much out there. His behavior, his character, it's an open book. It's not something he ever hides, And you have voters, you have some voters deciding they like it, some voters deciding they can overlook it, and some people are horrified by it. And it's not our job to I feel like I'm off on a tangent here, but given the question that you asked, but it's not, it's hard because you can put all this stuff out there and it can feel like, everything is sort of baked in. I mean, covering him, for 2.5 years now, we feel like every day for the most part, is somewhere between a 3-alarm fire and a 5-alarm fire. And yet, his approval number is basically a straight line from January of 2019 to now. And that would give you the impression that not much has really happened so far in the Trump administration. Obviously, that's not true. But people just sort of, for the most part, the public sort of seems to have decided what they think of the president, how they think about him, what they're willing to accept, what they can't accept. And that makes this a really interesting campaign because it's a referendum on a person who is really known publicly. Trump will try and make it a referendum on whoever the Democratic nominee is and try to bring their negatives up. We saw in 2016 he's capable of doing that. It's going to be interesting once we get to the general to see how oppo, how much of a factor that really is, as opposed to just sort of a daily news cycle or the hourly news cycle and sort of how much Trump can set that agenda with his Twitter account. Versus how much the media can restrain themselves and perhaps focus on more issue-focused things.
So, Eli, now instead of just covering candidates, you're actually covering the president and the White House. And from what I thought I heard you say, you're actually in the White House press pool. Is that right?
Yes.
So what is that like? I'm having visions of the TV show West Wing right now, of the gaggle of reporters and journalists in a room in the West Wing, you know, pinging questions off of the press secretary and having private moments on Air Force One or Marine One asking questions of the president. How similar is it? How very different might it be?
Well, I know that it's different, and I know that even without having covered another administration, right? Everybody will tell you that it's different. And I think we all just understand that. They did the briefings for a while. Now they don't do them anymore. And, you know, oftentimes, I mean, we're still attacking this the same way we would any administration, right? You're trying to find out information. You're trying to make sure that it's reliable. You're trying to get it out to the public. That's the job. It's still the job. But, you know, this is a little trickier because the president says a lot more. He's kind of always talking. But again, as I said, it's harder to really put a whole lot of faith in that what he says is going to be what eventually happens. You know, we obviously are at the White House in the offices of advisors, but, you know, a lot of times they only know so much. A lot of times the best reporting that you'll see coming out of this administration is what you see after the fact. No one knows what will happen, but after something happens, you'll see a lot of great reporting citing various administration sources, explaining or sort of painting a picture of how it happened. What did Trump say when he was in the room? Who influenced him to make the decision? And so I think, you know, the White House reporters have turned a lot more to those kinds of, you know, TikTok stories about how it happened or inside the moment when those kinds of stories. And, you know, they're interesting, they're readable, but also, you know, after a while, I mean, learning that Trump made a impulsive decision that some of his advisors counseled against, right? It's like that story feels like we're reading that all the time. So even those stories that are really juicy and anecdotal and interesting, you know, over 2.5 years, they start to feel stale. So it's a challenge. I mean, he's a great subject in the sense that, you know, it's like people can't look away. People want to read about it. So that's a great opportunity for us, but in doing things that are actually original and not just sort of scintillating or shocking, but things that are informative and of use to the public, you know, it's a challenge. And we just kind of go about it every day, making the best decisions we can, trying to decide, you know, when a tweet storm merits an article or when, you know, it's best left kind of just to live on Twitter and we can continue to spend our time worrying about, you know, working on other projects.
And unfortunately, Eli, we're running out of time, so I have just one more question for you, and it actually goes quite nicely with what you just said, and that is the topic of something informative for the public, and even this process of not knowing if what you're starting with will be the final product when the president's talking about a particular issue. You co-authored a piece about the recent budget deal that increased the debt limit and spending caps. That was a process that took months of negotiation and back and forth. Was that a frustrating thing for you to cover, or was it a nice change of pace?
Well, I'll tell you what was nice is having a great couple of Hill reporters who could also, you know, work with me to figure out sort of, you know, how this happened, why it happened the way it did. It was one of these situations where, you know, we sensed early on that this was just not a fight that the president wanted. We know he likes to fight about certain things, cultural issues, immigration, trade, but spending, you know, there are certain things. Spending is an area where he's probably more in line with the Democratic orthodoxy. He doesn't really care about, you know, the debt limit, like Republicans did, especially when Obama was president. And so he basically got Republicans to swallow this deal. And it was an interesting sort of illustration of how Republicans will pick their spots with this president. Sometimes if he throws up a nominee they don't like, they'll signal that he needs to find another nominee. But with stuff like this, you know, the Freedom Caucus folks, Rand Paul, they were annoyed that he was pushing this because they don't want to see more government spending. But by and large, the Republican rank and file said, well, this is kind of not what we supposedly believe in, but if Trump's for it, we're for it. We're just not going to make much noise. And, you know, he let Mnuchin and Pelosi hammer out the deal. Oftentimes his eyes get big at the idea of a Rose Garden signing ceremony. This one, he signed behind closed doors. There wasn't even a photo spray for the print photographers to get a picture of him signing it with his Sharpie. It was just an email that came out, the president has signed this budget deal. So as much as he didn't want to fight with Democrats, you know, he didn't necessarily want to make a big spectacle of it either, because, you know, it just, he didn't find it so much of a value to him. He found it as something that needed to get done, didn't want to fight, that was distracting from other fights and other messaging that he has. And it was unique, you know, as a moment in this White House where it was quiet and something bipartisan just got done.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Eli Stokols from the LA Times. We discussed what it's like covering elections and also riding on some substantive policy issues. Thanks for joining the show, Eli.
Thanks, Chase. Appreciate it.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.